just to have that name, social welfare.
Social ministry.
So social welfare has been converted to social ministry. Two consuls are here with us today, and they will do the introducing of our guest speaker. So Dr. Les Weber, a veteran of many wars, and a fine friend, and a compassionate pastor, Dr. Les Weber.
Thank you, Dr. Hanscher. Well, some of those wars that you referred to were fought up in East Boston, Massachusetts, when both of us were up there many years ago, and have continued on as we battle the forces of evil and the circumstances that cause hurts and suffering and burdens to many people. Social ministry is just in that area of concern. We are interested in helping the total person, and the total person has spiritual needs, and we're concerned about those. The total person has sometimes physical needs, social needs, mental needs, emotional needs, and so this is the concern of social ministry. Initially, as you may recall, this program was referred to as social welfare, because that was the in word at that particular time. And then it was changed from social welfare to social ministry, because we wanted to get across the concept that we're dealing with people. That's the root meaning of the word social. It means society, people needs, and as a ministry, it's a reaching out in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ to people who are in need in one way or another. Now, one of the leaders in this area of social ministry, of social welfare, was Dr. Henry Wind. Dr. Henry Wind was a man whom I believe is responsible for the creation of our board for social ministry or social welfare. He was born in 1891 and served the Lord in many capacities, especially in the areas of human need. He was a chaplain in the First World War. He was a parish pastor in Lockport, New York. He was a social worker, an agency executive, and by the way, the agency that he served for 35 years in Buffalo, known as the Lutheran Service Society of New York, is now the agency served by John Herford's father. John is here someplace this morning, and his father is the agency executive, one of our colleagues in this area of reaching out to people who are in need. Henry Wind is a man who was an outstanding social worker, an outstanding institutional chaplain, too. He served many capacities in the city of Buffalo, the institutions of the state of New York, and the county of Erie and Niagara in New York. He was a man who had a heart, a man who at one time was asked to be on the faculty of Concordia Seminary here, at one time was asked to be director of KFUO, our radio station. He was chosen as the first executive secretary for the Board for Social Ministry of our church. In 1950, that's when social ministry was established in our church, as a result of action taken at the Milwaukee Convention of our church that year. Henry Wind came to St. Louis in 1953. He served part-time in this executive position from 50 to 53, and he moved to St. Louis in 1953. Where he was a full-time executive. Back in those days, social ministry didn't get a very high priority in our church. In fact, we don't think it gets high enough priority now, but it's better than it was. At that time, there was $10,000 in the budget for the whole program. A national program on $10,000. Well, they did it. They got it started. They got Synod moving, thinking about the total needs of people, reaching out in the name of Jesus Christ to help people who are hurting. And this man helped to develop this whole program. Well, he didn't do it all alone. He had another great man who worked with him, and that man was from Minneapolis. His name was Buckley Glade, Dr. Edwin Buckley Glade. And I knew both of them and worked closely with both of them. And those two, Glade and Wind, were often referred to as the Gold Dust Twins. Because wherever you saw one, the other one was there. And each of those had an impact upon our synod to the point that today Our Senate recognizes this as one of the integral boards of our national office. We have comparable boards out in district offices, and we have encouraged congregations to have social ministry committees. It's been my privilege to serve this board since 1964. I have worked with Wind. I succeeded Wind in the executive spot, and I'm happy that today I have another member of my staff with me today, Reverend Paul Volk, whom some of you may have met. He is our secretary for district and parish social ministry. Paul, will you just stand up a minute? Good. Another member of our staff who is not here, but whom you've also met, is Reverend Melvin Witt, who is our secretary for World Relief. Not so long ago, he preached at chapel here on world hunger, and I think he had a seminar with some of the students, so some of you may remember him. And the fourth member of our staff is Mr. Virgil Fuchs, social worker, who is in charge of our agencies and institutions. You see, social ministry covers a broad spectrum of human needs. But today, we're going to focus attention particularly on institutional chaplaincy services. And we have for this special lecture, which we call the Henry Wind Memorial Lecture, the Reverend Dr. Edward Monty. Dr. Monty is a graduate of Concordia Seminary, class of 1943. He came out at a time when there was a war going. We were rushing the graduates out so that we could serve those who were in need in our parishes and throughout our country and throughout the world. Dr. Monty became involved in social ministry by getting involved in institutional chaplaincy services. He served as a chaplain here of the Lutheran Association of St. Louis, and later on became chaplain at Lutheran Medical Center here. Then he left St. Louis and went to Minneapolis, where he was chaplain at the University of Minnesota Hospital. And he left there to go to Texas, where he has been for the last 6 or 7 years, as chaplain and director of pastoral care at the MD Anderson Cancer Institute, part of the University of Texas Tumor Institute there in Texas there. And those of you that have been in Houston will perhaps remember what a grand complex of medical facilities there are right there in Houston. And he's right in the midst, able to bring his influence to bear and the influence of our church to many of those people in that area and in the medical complex. Dr. Monty knew Dr. Wynn personally, was a friend of Dr. Wynn, and also served as an advisory member of the Board of Social Welfare back in those days. So as some of you might know a little more about Wynn, I brought about 25 copies of a biography of Dr. Wynn with me this morning. They're yours for the asking. You may come up here and get one afterwards. Be glad to give it out. Also brought a couple of copies of A Century of Caring that traces the first 100 years of social ministry within our church from 1868, when the first agency was created, to 1968, when we celebrated the 100th anniversary of social ministry. And so with that much of an introduction on social ministry and a very brief introduction to Dr. Monty, who is our very special speaker this morning, and I know you're all waiting to hear from him. He's my personal friend, colleague in the institutional ministry field, a fellow worker in the kingdom of our Lord, and a man of compassion and concern. He's going to speak about institutional missionary work to specialized ministry. Dr. Ed Monty.
Thank you, Lord. It's a real honor to be asked to do this Wynn Memorial Lecture, and it's fun to come back here to a place that I haven't been able to visit very often, and to see a lot of friends that we have been with over the years. I'm thinking of Dr. Hensky. His father and my father were neighboring pastors in Milwaukee. And later on, we joined his congregation down here when we were on the south side of St. Louis, and he confirmed our two sons. We had a rather interesting kind of relationship and contact back and forth over the years, and there are a number of others here in the room that we have come to love and to cherish. Mrs. Philpo and Dr. Philpo, coming out of Freistadt, Wisconsin. So it's a real nice experience to be here. Dr. Wind was a good friend. We have some distinctions in the class of 43. We were the first class that got an A.B. degree from Sinnott. Until that time, you didn't have that. You, I guess the military probably pushed us into adding the necessary courses and everything so that we would qualify for a bona fide A.B. And so our class went to the seminary 3 years and then took our vicarage. But after the second year, we got an A.B. Then we vicared, and Pearl Harbor happened. And in spite of all this backlog of candidates waiting for calls, when our class graduated, everybody in the class eventually got a call, which was unheard of. Before that, one or two calls would be available. So we each were placed. And I was placed in City Missions here in St. Louis. And that began for me what was an interesting career. I ministered to a lady not too long ago, and I thought I had done a rather good job. When I got through, she says, "How long do you have to do this work before they give you a church?" And I want to acknowledge that I recognize that there are those people who still say, "When are you going to get in the active ministry?" And then there are those people who hear that I'm in a cancer center now who say, "Boy, that must be a depressing job. It must be terrible to be surrounded with cancer all the time." And they are surprised to hear me say that this is the most meaningful ministry that I have had in almost 40 years. It is a ministry that I never believed I would be able to have and that I would enjoy as much and be rewarded with. It's a ministry of hope. The word hope is a tremendously significant thing for these people that we're dealing with. Since the days of Luther, the Lutheran church, the Lutheran clergy have taken seriously a whole ministry to sick people. Pastoral care has been a big emphasis. If you've read Luther's letters of spiritual counsel, you see him helping people struggle through some of their difficulties, sometimes giving them just spiritual support, sometimes talking about the causes of their affliction. But his letters are extremely modern and up-to-date. And if you haven't read the book, I suggest that you get a hold of it, because it's the kind of thing where you can read one letter at a time and get an awful lot of Luther's spirit and attitude. The pastoral theology text that came out in the Lutheran church sometimes took more the form of a casuistry book, the systematics of casuistry. What do you do with divorce? What do you do with this and what do you do with that? But generally, the skills of pastoral care were emphasized in terms of a gospel-oriented support system. Now, we sometimes preach the gospel and live under the law, but I think that the pastoral care emphasis, for instance, of John Fritz's book, are pretty much gospel-oriented. Back over 125 years ago, something like that, a soldier who was dying and was without family here in Houston, or St. Louis, appeared at the parsonage of Reverend Johann Binger, who happens also to be the grandfather of Hank Wind. And he was looking for some help. Binger immediately moved into his congregation and solicited funds to buy a home in the area, and put this man into this home, and then from his membership recruited people who would nursed this man as he died. And Binger, of course, coming in with his spiritual messages and trying to help this man to eternal salvation in his dying days. That was the beginning of Lutheran Hospital. The interesting thing was that the neighborhood did not appreciate Binger's buying his home. They did not want a pest house put in their community. But Binger's orientation was an attitude was one where he was sensitive to people. He was described as a friend of missions, the father of Negro missions, founder of the Lutheran Hospital in St. Louis, the orphan's home, and the old folks' home. Besides offering a redemptive message, Binger also was deeply concerned in showing mercy to those people who were wounded and half dead on the road to Jericho here in St. Louis. As the hospital developed and their medicine became more sophisticated, they moved to bigger quarters. They eventually started a nursing education program. And in one of the accounts of that nursing school, it says that the community doctors were so impressed with the medical care being given at this hospital that they were sending their own patients over here. The visitation pastor played a very key role, and it was usually the pastor of Holy Cross Church who would come over and visit all these patients and try to give support in terms of word, sacrament, prayer, and then also to bring a message which would help the people come to a point of conversion, to present to the unregenerate God's plan of salvation. At another point in the history of St. Louis, many of these local clergy found that there were a lot of non-Christian, unregenerate people in the city jails and city hospitals. So they banded together and formed a thing called Lutheran City Mission and called Frederick Hetzberger to come in and be a visitation pastor. It was seen as an extension of the individual parishes. And he would go through the jails and through the hospitals looking for people who wanted his ministry. Sometimes, again, it was simply a supportive gospel ministry. Sometimes it was aimed at trying to convert these people before they died. In those early days, not many people really expected to recover and be healed when they went to a hospital. For the most part, it was people coming in expecting that they would die. Then in the late 30s and 40s, hospital administrators were becoming concerned about what was happening in their hospitals under the disguise of religion. People who were motivated by the love of Christ, who were very zealous in their desire to share heaven, also were very aggressive in their attack upon patients. And what happened at City Hospital here in St. Louis was that a former pastor, an E&R pastor, Mr. Smith, had been made administrator, and he became sick one day and was in his room in the hospital there as a patient when some religious worker walked in and woke him and said, "Are you saved?" Now that kind of put the movement on its way. He was going to control it because he felt that many of his patients were getting that same kind of treatment. Some of them were interpreting why people were sick because of sin. That's not something that has passed out of the picture. This last week in our hospital, we have a woman who has cancer, and her husband came into a family group meeting to announce to the group that the reason his wife was a patient at MD Anderson was that she had sinned, and that because of her sin, God had given her cancer. Now, this was last week, 1982. The chaplaincy and the medical team are working with this man, trying to evaluate with him why he makes that kind of an assessment of his wife's illness. Others try to say that if they are allowed in, and if your faith is right, and if you make the claim, you will be healed, either by prayer or by anointing or whatever it might be. Very rarely do these people try to make theology relevant to the situation that exists. They are more trying to lay their agenda on the people who are sick. And by using tactics which encourage fear and guilt, get the people to a state where they say, "I believe," or "I want to be converted because I want to get out of this fear and guilt that I'm experiencing. Now, administrators of hospitals called upon clergy, particularly hospital chaplains, who at that time were still primarily referred to as institutional missionaries, to somehow clean up their act, to develop a professional identity which would make it possible for them to work with medical professionals as peers. That they would not be coming in there simply as an appendage, but that they would be involved with the therapeutic process. At that time, or sometime before that, let's see, it'd be about 60 years ago or something like that, there was a man, Dr. Anton Boyson, who was a mental hospital patient. He had suffered several psychotic episodes. And while he was in the mental hospital, experienced a Sunday activity at the hospital in which community pastors came in, delivered the sermons they had presented to their congregations in the morning to these patients without variation or change. And he talked about how frustrating the experience was for him as a patient to feel that these people did not understand at all what was going on in the world of these mental patients. But he said he determined that someday he would try to educate seminarians to understand the world of these mentally sick patients, so that they would be able to do an effective ministry. I had the privilege, and I guess some honor with it, of doing my CPE back in 1947 up in the Edgerton State Hospital with Anton Boyson present. For 3 months, I lived in the room adjacent to him and was able to sit and talk with him evenings. At the time, I didn't fully appreciate the contributions that Boyson was making, because coming out of my own setting here, I was wondering if he was really as healthy as some other people thought. I mean, one of the things that he wanted to do was to develop a hymn book in which all negatives would be removed, blood, cross, crucifixion, and things like that. It wasn't until years later when I began to realize the wisdom of what he was trying to do for mentally sick people who already were depressed and who were so surrounded by negative concepts that they needed the kind of thing that he was offering, some hope, some positive direction towards a God who could love them in their great state of depression. But Anton Boyson started the clinical training movement up at Worcester, Massachusetts, took a few seminarians in there with the permission of the administrator, and they started working with patients. They worked in the state hospital there not because they wanted to just work with mentally sick patients, but because their human beings were available. They could send these people to function pastorally with these patients because nobody really cared. Nobody was coming in to call on these patients. If they were identified with a church, many of the pastors were somewhat reluctant to come in. They were probably not really afraid, but they were hesitant about coming in and dealing with these people because they didn't understand mental illness. And they were playing by kind of a rule of thumb, and so they very often extended their visits to these places over a long period of time. With the development of this clinical training program, hospital administrators caught on to it and said, we feel that this would be a good thing in a certification process for people who want to work in hospitals. That they would be exposed to people who are sick, work through the dynamics of relationships, begin to understand what these people are going through, and then appear before a committee to see how well they have put this all together, and then be brought into the hospital. What happened there was that patients were no longer seen as a captive audience. But you had them there, and they really couldn't run away from you. In my days here at the seminary, we had the Missionary Society, I think it was called, Student Missionary Society. That was before field work. You did this because you wanted to, not because it was an assignment. I remember going out here to the infirmary on Sunday morning, and you'd pull together four students to be a quartet and sing a hymn, and you'd do the preaching. And he'd walk into these wards or beds, and just, that was it. They couldn't get away, and we would start a service. And I remember one time one of the students asking a rhetorical question about where people would expect to go if they had not found Christ, and one man told him where he could go. And he just turned over, he had his back faced toward the service, and he was angry that this group was being made a captive audience. Now, I think that this is happening all over, but the move in clinical training said this is not the way to do it. We also learned that this is not simply a mission field, and above all, that an institution was not a place for proselytizing, for sheep stealing. Yesterday, down in Houston, I met with a man for an hour and a half. He belongs to or leads an interdenominational non-sectarian church. So, of course, he has no category in the place that he fits into and can call on patients. So he said it's his right to to call on all patients to see if they want his ministry. While in the university, there is a rule about solicitation that says you can't do that. You can go to the people who request your services, or you can go to the people who are members of your parish, but you cannot go bed to bed as you come in from the outside and just solicit people for your ministry. The American Protestant Hospital Association was formed by these administrators, and the College of Chaplains became a section of that. And in the College of Chaplains, there was a certification process set up whereby people would go into clinical training and have their work evaluated and examined and their person examined, and then they would be certified. We began in the late 40s, and this last year, I believe they admitted somewhere around the 1,600 members. They're at number 1,600. My certificate, I think, is 101. So you can see how many people have been willing to go through this process over the years. Clinical training has been a requirement for this certification process from the beginning. It didn't say that clinical training would make a good chaplain, or that people without training could not be good pastors. But they had finally found a process by which some training could be presented and some evaluations could be made by which they could test pastors for effectiveness and their relevancy in ministry. Now, you're going to find some who got through who are not necessarily good pastors, and you're going to find a lot whose theology you don't agree with. But this new process had been started, and the administrators now were saying to us that we should develop a professional identity. I don't know how much you've thought about your professional identity yet, but I think it's a critical issue that you have to take a look at. And I've tried to line up a few things that I'd like you to look at. Number one, the popular word today is look at your pilgrimage. Take a look at where you've come from. A pastor is a servant of Jesus Christ, we know that. He's a minister of the gospel. But what do we understand by these words? What does it mean to us? When a pastor describes himself, he usually describes his vocation. It is not easy for pastors to see themselves as persons and as pastors, to take a look at who they are as human beings, and then take a look at who they are as professional, vocational pastors. We do not ask the pastor to reject the parental home out of which he came, the values, the environment in which he grew up, but rather that he assess his environment and make decisions that will help him use this experience, the place where he grew up, in planning his vocational objectives. I don't know if we realize how many of the things that we grew up with have really become part of our person in such a way that we don't really understand that people could have grown up in a different setting and be quite different. 2 years ago, we were over in Japan, and I think the cultural difference is so marked. I mean, the politeness with which people treat you. The hotel bellboys and stuff bowing and saying hi, hi, and you know they don't understand a word you say, but they are embarrassed that they don't understand your language. They don't say, well, why don't you speak Japanese to us? That kind of a cultural emphasis, the whole lack of crime and the respect for authority, the respect for the aged, that they don't talk to people who have cancer over there and say, well, you have cancer, we have to treat that. They do not tell a patient that they have cancer. They are mixed in with all the other patients on the floors and are treated, and although the patient may be going down, 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 becoming very depressed, they are never told you have cancer because they see it yet as something of a death sentence. And it is very much in contrast to walking up to our place and seeing this big lettering across the front of the place, MD Anderson Cancer Institute. So we couldn't do that at home. So the culture out of which we come, the background in which we have been raised, is important, and it's better for us to review and examine our biases and prejudices and our loves and hates a little bit objectively rather than perpetuate misunderstood standards and values that we've accumulated in Ruth. That these things have become a part of us because we grew up that way. I grew up in a setting where you didn't play cards or a bridge deck. You could use the same games and use a rook deck and it was all right. But a bridge deck was wrong. It was called the Devil's Prayer Book and all kinds of other names. And it was preached against regularly and consistently by the pastors. Now, there were reasons for this, I suppose. They didn't want people to go into the saloons and gamble with a bridge deck. But to understand that this carried over, and my mother really felt uncomfortable holding cards in her hand. I mean, she had been so conditioned and trained, she couldn't see them simply as cards. Rook deck is fine. There were all kinds of other things that we have changed from in insurance. My grandfather was put on his first discipline because he put an insurance policy on his barn because he had burned out twice from lightning hit. And elders of the church came out and said that he lacked faith in God when he bought insurance policies. And his description of that was still very vivid in my mind. That he said, here they stood with boots on, overcoat, scarves, gloves, hats, protecting themselves against the cold weather, telling me that I didn't have faith in God because lightning hit my barn twice and I needed some protection. But these are the things that we need to look at as we go back over our lives and see, what did I come to? What are the experiences I had? What are the values that have been put into my life? You take that human being now and add to that the body of knowledge. You're here studying theology to give you an understanding of sin, God, redemption, man, eternity. But most of us have been educated in seminaries of our own denomination so that we kind of perpetuate what we have already begun to see and learn as children. But the variation isn't that great. And the childhood program develops as right or wrong unless we can also stay open to the idea that sometimes there are differences which do not have a right or wrong concept. That as you develop your body of knowledge, you need to learn to be open to people who have been raised in another setting and who are just as Christian as you and I are, but look at it from a different point of view. Wayne Oates and I were riding one time and getting ready for mealtime, and he said to me, he said, if you have a drink before dinner, go ahead. That's all right with me. It doesn't offend me. He said, I was raised in a Baptist community where they don't drink alcoholic beverages, and so I don't drink. He says, you were raised in a German Lutheran community where they drink beer like water, and so it doesn't bother you. He says, it has nothing to do with our relationship to God in Christ, but it comes out of the background and the culture in which we're raised. And so this body of knowledge has to be open to the cultures and the settings in which we have been raised so that we can be in the world of the person we're talking to. Then there are special skills that become part of our identity. After you have your own personal history and your body of knowledge put together, each individual has innate skills and some that have been developed. Some of them have a great ability to listen, some can interpret, analyze. Others integrate what they call their gut feelings with intellectual formulations. When that happens, there is a capability of developing relevance. When I can get a hold of what I'm really feeling about something and put that together with what I know intellectually, I can probably be quite relevant to the situation. It's not a question of determining everything on the basis of feelings or on the basis of facts, but the combination of the two. If you have negative feelings about a given thing, you start with negative. And it's going to be very difficult for you to put that together with straight facts. One of the illustrations that I think of is that when we were first married here in St. Louis, my wife could fry eggs exactly like I like them. Not many people do. But she could turn them over so that the yolk would still be running, and I loved it that way. And I enjoyed that thoroughly. But sitting across the table from her, she would take her knife and cut through the yolk and then take her post and Dob the yoke. Academically, intellectually, there's nothing wrong with that. It's a perfectly legitimate way to even age. But I had to tell her that my reaction was extremely negative, so negative that I was in danger of throwing up. And she said, well, that's silly. I'm just eating the egg like a lot of people do. I said, yes, but I have been chaplain in City Hospital, and I see you swallowing pus out of a wound. And that does do things to you. Now, today, I think I could tolerate that, but at that point in my life, my negative approach to that just could not be dealt with in my head. And fortunately, she was loved me enough that she wrote, it bothers me that much, I won't do it. Then I need also, you know, to take a look at how I could handle this a little bit more in my head than in my feelings. But I'm saying this to say, when you talk about your special skills, don't ignore the feelings you may have. There may be very positive feelings towards something and you're going to be gung-ho in supporting it. There may be very negative feelings and you're going to prove to somebody it doesn't work. So that as you develop your identity, you need to put those two together. Then there are the standard, essentially ethical. Most of us have grown up believing that this is the appropriate thing to do. We haven't analyzed it, we haven't thought about it, we haven't said, well, because of this, and that. But no, my mother was the kind of a person who would say a pastor doesn't do that. And I'd say, why? Well, I don't know, but a pastor just doesn't do that. When I went to prep school, my grandfather said, well, now, if you're going to start studying for the ministry, you shouldn't go to the movies so much. Well, we lived out in the country, and going to the movie meant probably every 6 weeks or something like that. On a Sunday afternoon, we'd go in, but that was now, and when he'd asked him, well, why not? Well, pastors couldn't do it. See, it wasn't appropriate. And when we form our own identity, I think we have to ask ourselves, is it a matter of right and wrong, sin and holiness? Is it a question of differences of opinion? But it does call for personal choice. And depending upon where we stand, our whole identity will be tangled in with our concepts of the ethical, our priorities, and our standards, what we really feel is appropriate. Somebody one time, as they were preparing an order of worship that was to be published and printed, put a footnote in that said, the music should be in good taste. And my comment was, I have not yet seen people say, my taste in music is not good. So everybody says, well, if it's country western, that's good taste. If it's liturgical, it's Bach, whatever. See, we start from the idea that my taste is good taste. Everything different from that is not in good taste. And the other fellow says, well, I don't know. I think I start from the same place. What I think is good taste. And I don't think yours is any good at all. So as we look at that and take a look at our role identity, look at the standards by which you're examining. Then the next thing is the Holy Christian Church in Capital and the Church. How do I look at the communion of saints? I confess I believe in the communion of saints, the Holy Christian Church. Now, what do we do with the differences among the communion of saints? I am surrounded by Southern Baptists right now and Church of Christ people. And there are some marked differences in the way they apply their theology to living from the way I do. Now, what do we do with those differences? How do we see this? Our role identity is shaped by what we see there as right or wrong. What is necessary for relationship to God in Christ for redemption? What is now a matter of choice? Because my role identity is going to be set on the way I view this, and very much of my attitude and my personality is going to reflect the way I look at these differences. What are my values? I don't know if they still use that test here, but there used to be an all-court set of values test that was given to students when they came into the seminary. And I remember going through that test with some seminarians, and they were shocked that they didn't come out high in the religious. The test at the end showed that you're either social, philosophical, moral, political, or aesthetic. Moral was the religious. But among you, the values vary very much. I mean, some of you may be very conscious of your social activity, others of you very conscious of search for truth, the philosophical, others power, the political, others and beauty, the aesthetic. We need to take a look and see what my value system is, because it colors my decision-making and eventually my role identity. I may not feel comfortable worshiping in a concrete block building because I have an aesthetic system which says I like stained glass and I like a good order. And so I don't find the worship experience as good in a concrete block building with a piano. That starts shaping my role identity. When a pastor has examined his professional identity, he needs to study how he views the relationship of religion, his expression of his relationship to God, with faith. To take a look at the way faith or religion responds to illness and therapy. Some studies show that the recovery rate of patients was improved by people who had a belief system, not necessarily a Christian belief system, but a doctor who was down in the South Pacific and was bored by not being able to do anything during World War II, began making these surveys among servicemen, and our psychiatrist pointed it out to me that he showed and documented it and wrote it, and it's been printed, but been stuck in the back shelves of a library out east, that people with a belief system recovered at a better rate than those without. I think the Coconut Grove fire is another illustration and documentation of that. Other studies have been done up in Michigan among the parents of children with cancer, and it showed that their priority, when they were asked what is most important to you, second, third, fourth, in the program of therapy for your child, that survey came out that religion was the most important. Because when people responded, we know that medicine is going to run out eventually, and we want to hope that religion offers for eternity. On the basis of these studies, next year in March, our pediatric oncology department is sponsoring a mental health program, which they do annually, and the focus is going to be on pastoral care and chaplaincy to the parents and children who have cancer. So when we talk about establishing a professional identity, we are not being brought into a hospital because it's nice to have religion around or they can't keep us out, but because the medical people are acknowledging and recognizing the value of a good pastoral care department. They want it there. They want us to participate in discharge planning, in staffing, diagnostic, pain clinics, because they see the very integral part that spirituality, religion, and personal faith belief system has in the way this person responds to their illness and responds to their therapy. You need to, as a chaplain, working with a medical staff, be able to help the staff understand the specific religious belief system of these people, because they usually have grown up in one church or one denomination, and that's all that they bring to the situation. We had a case recently of a young boy who was critically ill. His prognosis was extremely poor. He was expected to die very shortly. And yet the father sat next to the boy's bed playing hymns to the child. And when anybody would come in, he would say to them, "My boy's going to get well. You watch. God's going to give us a miracle." And then he would pray out loud with his boy. And the mother participated with it too. It upset the staff extremely because they said, "This child has no way. There is no way that that child can recover. There's been so much damage and he's going to die." And they are not facing reality, and we feel an obligation to have them face reality. He can recover. There's been so much damage and he's going to die. And they are not facing reality, and we feel an obligation to have them face reality, because they're going to come apart at the seams when this child dies. Picked up his tape recorder and picked up the personal belongings and was packing them away. And one nurse, in a good deal of anger, went into that room and confronted him And she says, you would not let us tell you that the child was going to die. We tried to tell you over and over again that this is going to happen, and you rejected it, you denied it, you just bypassed us, and now here it is. Where is your miracle? What was all your faith about? The man picked up the suitcase, and he turned to her, and he said, I'm very busy. I have to bury my dead son. But when I have that taken care of, I'll come back and talk to you about my faith. He said, the Lord decided not to do the miracle. And that's acceptable to me, too. I can accept the fact that he took the child, is the way the father put it. He said, that doesn't disturb me. That's part of my faith system. But I guess my concern is that somehow in this, quote, making people face reality, that we do not want to let them have that last tiny hope they have for recovery. That somehow there are people who have read Kubler-Ross and have felt that now you've got to face it, that person's going to die, and there's no way out of it. And I say to myself, if that were my own father, if I was at that bed, there's no way that I would want somebody to come in there and tell me, face it, he's not going to make it. I was facing the fact that he was in critical illness, that he was dying. But there was still in the back of my mind that one little hope that maybe, yes, he was going to make it. And I don't think anybody has the right to take that kind of a hope away from me. I think it's cruel to feel that you've got to push people into that kind of facing of reality, because my experience has shown that these people do not, yes, they grieve and they come apart. We had a lady whose daughter died in the hospital, and I was called, got into the room, took one look at me, and she says, here he comes. Tell me now. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away. Go ahead, tell me. That's what you preachers say, isn't it? I sat back silently because I knew she was just too angry to hear anything. She began to beat on the wall. She threw herself over the corpse. And then the doctor walked in and says, here come the vultures. Now he wants to do a post on my daughter. You're not going to get my baby. And she carried on, and the doctor and I simply stood back and let her do anything. We had agreed that she can do anything she wants as long as she does not hurt herself. If she wanted to put her hand through the window, we would stop her. And she beat on the floor. She crawled on the bed with the baby. She did everything imaginable, and she was angry with God. She was angry with us. But then, 3 months later, she wrote back and said that she really now appreciated that nobody stopped her. She said, I was so angry. If you had tried to stop me, I would have really become violent. But she said, you let me get all that out of my system, and I'm okay now. She said, I am still a good Christian. I'm going to church. I have not been thrown aside by that. Is religion a way of telling people why they are sick? Or, as some people feel and tell their patients, that they will be cured by a strong faith and a potent prayer? Can we allow the patient to deal with his sickness in ways acceptable to the patient? Can we allow that? Or do we feel we have to redirect that? I think once in a while, yes, we need to hold up a mirror to them to see what they are experiencing, what they're going through. But the theme is that we enter the world of the patient. I remember being at Lutheran Hospital here in St. Louis as a chaplain some years ago, when a lady came in. Her morning had been that she had gotten up, made breakfast, sent her husband off to work. Everything was fine. Within a half hour, her child was dead. And there was no known cause, at least as far as at that point that we know. We rushed him into the hospital there, and we put him into emergency, and she was in the hall, and they asked me to go and see her. And in my own naive way, I said, I understand how you feel. And she turned on me, and she said, there's no way you can understand how I feel. And she was right. But it was a nice cliche that I had. I understand how you feel. How do you like that when people come up to you and say, I understand how you feel, and you know that they don't? There's no way that I could possibly understand her. It taught me a tremendously important lesson, and that is to try and get into the world of the patient and hear what that world is like. Get in there and listen to a 38-year-old man who has a young daughter, 15 years old or something like that. He's got cancer. It looks terminal. What is it like to live in that kind of a world? He's just starting off on his own in his business. He's well respected by his family and his church and everything else. But now, what is it like to be in that world? Another man I walked into last week, 75 years old. When I came into the room, he said to me, "I'm not ready to die yet." At home, the doctor said to me, "You've got cancer." He says, "There's no way you're going to survive it. You've had a long, full life. Set your house in order and get ready for death." He says, "I'm only 75. He says, "My father was 95 when he died. I got 20 more years to go." So he said, "I want a referral to MD Anderson." And he came down, and our doctors are saying to him that they really think with his spirit and with the chemotherapy that's available that they can help extend his life considerably. I'm not saying that we can always do that. There are people who come in who die. But I think the important thing is to be in that world and understand what that person is going through and how he is experiencing God, how he experiences his relationship with God. When a person describes his God and how he maintains his relationship with him, I think of an old man who was 90 years old, and when I came in to see him, he said, "You know, I prayed that God should somehow show me what heaven was going to be like." And he said, "I prayed for this," because his family was pretty well disintegrated and gone, and he was there alone and lonesome. Then he said, "One night after supper, I came into my room here, and I sat down, and all of a sudden," he says, "my room lit up." And he said, "I saw the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in my life," and he described it. He saw family members. It was like a big wood. He loved brush trees and woods and lakes. He even had horses in there because he liked horses and dogs. And then when he got through, he looked at me and there were tears in his eyes. He said, "You can't tell everybody this." I said, "What do you mean you can't tell?" He said, "Well," he said, "if you say this to some people, they're going to say, ah, Otto, you must have eaten something for supper that upset you." This beautiful vision this man had, and he was experiencing this as some message that God was giving to him, is now being just dumped on by somebody who says, "Oh, you must have eaten something that upset you." And that's tragic. I mean, we can't get into the world of a patient enough so that we can enjoy or be threatened by what they are experiencing. When we talk about getting into relationships, we have to make the environment safe. You cannot be safe with each other if the environment is filled with adversaries. If I feel that you're out to get me here or there or some other place, and I've got to kind of lie in order to maintain a relationship, we just can't get any place. It's got to be safe so that I can bare my soul and be acceptable to you. I think that's the story of the woman at the well, where Jesus makes it safe and yet can hold up mirrors to us for her to look at. Now, clinical pastoral education is a program that I'm very deeply involved in, where theologically trained people pastor patients and look at their professional capabilities, their skills, look at their own person. Who am I? How do I relate? And what is my professional role? In the who am I think is the important part, that we find out who we are, what our values are, what our tastes are, and how we are going to put that in motion as we relate to people. How do I relate to people? Do I use guilt? Do I use anger? Do I use fear to try and make them behave? Do I manipulate them? Or can I relate to people openly and above board in an honest way? Then what is my professional role? How do I see myself thinking theologically and acting pastorally with these people? And when we get into a place like I have at the University of Texas, it's an interesting thing that the things that divide the Christian community outside the hospital have very little to do with what's going on inside the hospital. There we are down to what's called the nitty-gritty. We are down to what the people see as really valid and important: forgiveness, acceptance by God, eternal redemption. They are really not going to get involved with the division. And the relationship between chaplain and patient is very much based on the way they can relate to that personality
more than what denominational label he carries. This is interesting when you observe some things going on. We had a Catholic doctor who flew in with his son. The son died when they landed at the airport. The doctor, of course, knew the child was dead, but they had come in from Mexico City. So he called the hospital and said, "We are coming in. Will you please call the chaplain?" They called the priest. The priest was not fluent in Spanish. He could use a few words. He could do the sacramental things. And after the priest had done this, he said to the doctor, "I am going to call the Lutheran chaplain and ask him if he would talk to you pastorally. Because Gil Olivares, Mexican, fluent in both English and Spanish, could sit down with them and be pastoral to them." Now this is the kind of thing which does happen in this kind of a setting. That's why I say the way we view the church small letter and the communion of saints is going to be terribly important. Now in summation or conclusion here, I think the problem that I see is that we as a church, and this includes all denominations, have not fully recognized the ministry that is needed in these settings, hospital settings, prison settings. Our place is unique because only 12% of our people come from the county in which we are. The rest come from all over the world. So they're completely separated from their pastoral care that they would experience back home. And then it's a disease on which we expect only a 50% recovery rate. Half the people know that they are not going to recover. So the emphasis there on pastoral care gets heightened tremendously from across the street where they go in for heart surgery and are back out in a week. They have a 98% recovery rate. You know, people don't take too seriously that I may die in this, I may be facing my eternity, when they know the gallbladder will be out and I'll be okay. But it's a different story in our setting. In our medical center, there are 165 acres and there are 8 major hospitals. The 40,000 people are on that medical center a day. In our hospital alone, we have 530 beds open and we see 1,000 outpatients per day. And the new predictions are that we're going to 900 beds with 3,000 outpatients per day. And these people are looking for pastoral care. The reason they're going to this huge outpatient is to cut the cost of hospitalization. If they can take their chemotherapy and go back to a motel room, they can save themselves $150 a day. So that's the program. That's the way they want to try and develop it. And that means we have to have pastoral care available to these people who come from all points in the world. Beside the fact that the institution itself is looking for that kind of support for their patients. A doctor came by the office the other day. He has given me $2,000 in the last 3 months for a devotional literature account, which is to be used only for the purchase of Christ-centered evangelical material. The director of our hospital is the brother of a Catholic bishop. The president of our institution has been on the board of the Presbyterian Seminary in Austin. And down the line, Richard Jesse, who is head of the head and neck surgery, is the one who for 17 years chaired the committee which got the chapel built. So you see the kind of milieu in which you're working. But the problem I have is convincing the church that there is a need for ministry among people of this kind. Not just taking care of our bona fide Missouri Synod Lutheran, but a need for ministry among people who are facing this kind of a future, who need to be involved with the hope that religion offers to them. Among the Lutherans, we have dropped from 120 trained Lutheran supervisors to 90 at a time when we should be going the other direction. I had some statistics from the American Protestant Hospital Association. From 1974, there were 7,100 hospitals in the country. 1980, there were 7,000. There was a drop of 100 because of federal cutbacks and state. Now, breaking down the types of hospitals isn't that important. There were 48, half of them were federal, state 23, nonprofit 25, and investor hospitals 3%. Now, the investor hospitals are the ones who are recruiting chaplains. The corporations who have gotten together and formed hospital programs are out seeking chaplains because they see that this has to become a part of their program. The increase in chaplaincy has just been phenomenal over the last 7-8 years. And it's coming from the institution. It's not coming from the church. That's, you know, a commentary on why people say, why don't you get back in the active ministry? I don't think that the church still sees ministry in this kind of a setting as the same as the active ministry in the parish. If any of you have any questions or have any interest, I brought a few brochures along on clinical training down there at Anderson. I will be here this afternoon to talk to some of you. I know at least a couple of you are coming down to Houston in the next year, fall, for a year. I'll be glad to respond to any questions you have.
Thank you very much, Ed. What a challenge. 500 beds for patients who are coming in, 1,000 a day in the outpatient. What a challenge for the church to be there, where people are facing life and death situations every day. The prognosis, 50% of the patients are going to get well. The other 50% need to know that Jesus Christ is their Lord and their Savior. And many churches don't understand the challenge that we have in the institutional ministry. What we need are more Lutheran chaplains. What we need is a recognition that the chaplaincy ministry is really a specialized ministry, not a sub-branch of the ministry of Jesus Christ, not something that should be treated as an orphan, but something that ought to be right up there at top level with all other ministries of the church. Well, Dr. Monti's been involved in this kind of ministry for years, and I know he's available and willing to answer questions. I saw Dr. Klotz moving up here a moment ago. Maybe he wants to ask the first question, but I want to say I'm delighted that he's with us this morning, and also some of the other members of the faculty, too. Dr. Klotz, want to ask the first question?
No, I really have no questions. I came up to be sure that we could thank you for coming.
Oh!
Get the question.
Okay. How about a question or two? All right, over here. Here's a question.
I think there are a couple of things. We could not have our ministry without congregations. I don't ever want to forget that. I mean, the parishes are the ones who teach us that special ministries exist. But this is not a problem of the Lutheran Church, the Missouri Synod. It's a problem of all churches. The only church that has really, well, the Episcopal, Lutheran, and Catholic, have generally been in the leadership of institutional chaplaincy, because of the sacramental emphasis. But all the churches, Baptist, Methodist, Presbyterian, just see that they'll take care of the members of their parish, but do not see a responsibility for people outside. And I think it's just that idea. Now, for instance, the Jewish is even more pronounced. If you don't belong to the congregation, there's no way another rabbi is going to serve you. Because, like, Ford servicing Chevrolet. I guess my off the top of my head definition would be that the congregation is a group of believers who have united around Christ and are filled by the Holy Spirit to respond to the needs in the community around them. Like Binger, you know, he saw this dying soldier. He didn't say, are you Lutheran Missouri Synod? He said, let's put him into a house and take care of him.
and at the same time bring him the gospel. I think that's my idea, is that we have to develop a consciousness and awareness and get over the biases and prejudices we may have and see the human beings out in the community as people that we need to respond to.
I have two questions. One deals with a considerable increase in terms of the nonprofit community hospital, in terms of chaplaincy. The Catholic hospital association has always had chaplaincy, but what about the nonprofit community hospital? What is the percent of increase there in the last 5 or 10 years?
That is where the highest percent of increase has come. In the nonprofit hospitals, I believe the percent of increase is something like 40%. And they have established pastoral care departments, have called in chaplains, and are setting up programs.
And another question related to that is, in terms of the financial support, is it coming from within the hospital association themselves, or is it coming from the congregation supporting the hospital? Are both going on, or is that another possibility to support?
Denominational hospitals usually take it out of their budget, you know, their operating program there, but then they only hire people of their denomination. In city county hospitals, very often it's an issue of whether tax money can be used, so they'll probably hire a coordinator and then ask denominations to support. And that's where it breaks down, because the denominations do not feel the responsibility. They will be glad to put people in if the hospital will pay the bill. And with the rising costs of hospitalization, this is becoming less and less a possibility. In our place, because it is University of Texas, a teaching institution, and with Madeline O'Hare in Austin, we have to very carefully see to it that we do not use tax money to hire all these chaplains. We've got 10 full-time chaplains, 2 are paid by the state, 8 are paid by denominations, and 3 part-time.
And could I just add on to your comments on this? Our Lutheran Church Missouri Synod has a good record of providing funding for chaplains. However, in the last several years, we have decreased the amount of funds, and that's been largely due to the financial problems within our own church. Our districts have had problems, and so if a chaplain retired or died, so frequently his position was not filled. However, there's a new lease on life. Forward in Remembrance has designated funds for 11 new chaplains during this next year. So I think that, again, the church is beginning to assume a greater role in providing chaplains. Okay. Another question over here, Ed.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was just going to ask, does the Lutheran Church in Jerusalem have an organized approach to developing chaplaincy programs for hospitals who are requesting or committed to requesting that kind of program?
It varies in different parts of the country, I would say. I was in Minnesota, and there we had a very active and aggressive leader who was going into communities and looking at the hospital, establishing the need, and then going back to the church and saying, we need to put a chaplain in. They had 65 Lutheran chaplains in Minnesota. Now, in Texas, it's a little bit different, where the Texas philosophy has been, if congregations will come to us and say we will underwrite the cost, we will go look for a chaplain and put them in and they can pay for them. And that's very two different stances. I mean, with the largest medical center in the world is there in Houston. I don't know, have any of you seen that medical center down there where they're doing this heart surgery, DeBakey and Cooley and all these people? But it is the largest in the world in terms of size alone and the number of patients. We have one retired LCA Lutheran pastor serving that place. Now, they can't count me and John Stelling because we are hired by the state. And I think this is what I mean, that we need chaplains in there. We need pastors in there. Our place alone, we have 6,000 employees. And the need of these people for support and undergirding in dealing with cancer, you know, when 50% of your people are dying, you have to have a very special spiritual faith and attitude to stay working in there.
Yeah, my question is going to be, what would be the process that you would recommend for a student or for a parent to prepare himself for the community?
Well, you will need a minimum of a year of clinical training.
What do you mean by that? Is that part-time, full-time?
Well, you can put that together either, part-time or full-time. If it's, you take an extended unit while you're a parish pastor, you do also, you should have parish experience. I am firmly convinced that when you graduate, your vicarage year probably has been a parish. Take 2-3 years of parish experience. But then in your planning, anticipate that you're going to resign, step out, get some scholarship funds. Most of these programs have some stipend money. And go in and prepare yourself and go in that direction. Make a career of it. In other words, instead of saying, well, when I get to be about 55, 60, I think then I'll move over to chaplaincy. Because the problem I have, we've got two excellent retired men. I mean, they are beautiful pastors. But they don't understand the commitment you make that when you're on call at night, you come in when they call you. They'll say, boy, it's 3 o'clock. Do they really need me? You know, and they see this as a retirement program, and we can use them. We do excellent pastoral care. But I think we need people with a lot of physical health and well-being to stand the gas. The Institute of Religion has a very extensive program of lay training. We have about 25 lay volunteers who come in and visit. I support this because it maintains our contact with the patients. They can go up and make new admission calls, and they can make routine pickup calls when somebody's asking and find out what's needed. The problem I see with lay volunteers is that they have not the theological base that is needed once in a while to deal with issues that these patients have. And it comes off too frequently with some very moralistic or, homemade religion. Now, and I think that they are very fine people to keep us in touch. But I think when you get into an intensive care like a cancer institute, they need to have a theological base also with which they can work. For the lay people? Yeah, we indicate that they have gone through a training period. And I don't want to put them down because I'm using 25. I mean, they do a good job, but we do have to point out their limitations.
I would think that when you work with your patients in the hospital, many of them would have parish pastors or congregations they belong to and pastors who might visit them. What is your relationship to parish pastors who come into the hospital? Do you make an effort to work with them or not at all? How does that work?
We absolutely work with them. We never say that when a patient talks about my pastor, they're talking about their home pastor. They're not talking about, I am a pastor, I am a chaplain. And we want to work with them in interpreting for the pastor sometimes what is happening in the institution with that patient, and then be available to the institution also to help them see what's happening back in that community. One quick illustration, we had a Finnish Lutheran from the Apostolic Lutheran Church, and the boy was losing his sight and had heart disease on top of it, and the well-meaning people said they rented a TV and put it in his room. And the boy said, well, he says, I'm losing my sight. The only way I will use my eyes is to read the Bible. And the nurse says, oh, come on, you can watch some of these cartoons as entertainment. And I had to explain to the institution that if he went back to New York Mills, where he was from, and had been watching TV, this would be a scandal among the church members because they were so against that kind of secular thing. And then the institution backed off and said, well, let's not push something on him that's going to isolate him when he gets back home. We never replace the pastor. But if the pastor needs information, or needs some guidance, or needs to be involved with the discharge planning, what we're trying to develop is good contact for discharge planning. When we send somebody home to their community, we need the pastor to instruct the membership on how to receive this cancer patient. Some people will not want to go to communion and think it's contagious. Others will say, well, they can't marry, that's contagious, you know, and they isolate. So you have to, we're setting up cancer seminars just to try and instruct clergy and make them a liaison between us and their community. Same way with screening prevention. We're trying to get pastors interested in offering their church properties for screening so that the community could come in there with a team of doctors and screen patients, screen their membership, because some of these cancers are 100% curable. There's one in East Texas that's 100% curable if it's found. So we have all kinds of liaisons between us and the community church.
What I
perceive
is that the
pastor's
role is also taking on
some
of the role of the
MSW,
the social worker
of
the hospital.
Yeah, that's right. And that's the thing that Binger was doing, you know. He said, we can't let this fellow die out here in the streets. He said, we got to find a place for him. Cancer is a disease that is unique in that once you have been diagnosed as having cancer, every pain you have somehow gets correlated to that first diagnosis. If you have a tumor removed from your chest and subsequently you have an ache in your ankle, the first thought that goes through you, I wonder if it has metastasized or if it's down in my legs now. And so it's not like that with a gallbladder. So you have a unique disease. But this also applies to other things. I mean, people who have been diagnosed as having an illness need to have some special attention. Yeah. Well, most of it we've developed ourselves. There's a congregation up in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, who gave us a grant of $2,000 to try and do some developing of this material. What we use is a verbatim, the interaction between two people. And we have taken live ones and eliminated the names and then present them to the group and say, okay, how would you handle it? Fill in the spaces where the visitor is responding. And then we have some lectures from just giving professional data. So we're in the process of putting this together now. You don't want it to be like a fully brushed salesman material. You know, it's got to be the human being interacting.
You indicated quite a lot of failures related to
lack of theological grounds.
You attempt to address that in
the training. Very much so, because we need to help them see that homemade religion is one thing, theology is another. You know, the difference is for me. Homemade sentimentalities and things like this may not be appropriate. They may feel very sorry for the patient. The patient doesn't want them to feel sorry. The patient wants something stronger. So that's the only way I can describe it is that we try to have them take a look at the difference between sound biblical theology and a homemade religion.
Any other questions? I think a lot of attention has come from over this side regarding lay visitation. I would like to just add to what Dr. Monty has indicated, that Project Compassion of our church is such a program to help train volunteers. Now, this is not a deep theological presentation that's given to them, but it is providing some hints as to how to relate to other people, to understand the sick person, to be a good listener, and so forth. This is a program that's now in its 10th year, and I would certainly recommend this to your use when you're out in the parish. Project Compassion, it's put out by the Boards of Social Ministry Services of our church. It's a proven and accepted program for lay people. We've gotten a citation from the National Council on Aging, for the emphasis that we're giving in relating to older persons. Well, I want to thank Mrs. Soslow and the members of the faculty and staff for arranging for this opportunity this morning for this Wind Memorial Lecture. I want to indicate to you that some of these books on Dr. Wind are available here free of charge if you'd like one. Read the story of one of the greatest leaders of our church. We talk about Binger. We talk about Walter, we talk about some of the other great leaders of our church, and among them I number Dr. Henry Wind. So read and find out how he helps to pave the way for our church to be involved in a ministry to whole persons. And don't forget, Dr. Monty will be available up here from 1:30 to 2:30 this afternoon for any of you that may want to ask questions or come and speak with him. Thank you very much. That's Clark.
Well.